You are Locked On Rockets, your daily Houston Rockets podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Welcome in to another new episode of Locked On Rockets, your home for daily podcast commentary on all things Houston Rockets basketball. As always, I'm your host, Ben Dubose, Rockets correspondent with Sports Talk 790, the team's official radio flagship in Houston. On this Tuesday evening, to get some national perspective on this current Rockets four-game winning streak, I'm joined on today's show by national NBA columnist and friend of the show, Nikias Duncan, who you can follow on Twitter at NikiasNBA. Nikias, how are you, my friend?
I am doing quite well. How about yourself?
Cannot complain at all. I'm doing quite well, too, especially with the Rockets suddenly winning games again. That makes everything a lot more fun. And to provide an outline for our listeners, this will basically be a roundtable discussion over the next 20 minutes or so. We'll touch on James Harden, Chris Paul, Clint Capella, and a number of other key items involving the Rockets and their current level of play. But to start with, as with anything related to Houston these days, it's got to be James Harden off the top. And during this four-game winning streak, the most recent being Monday's win over Utah, in which he scored 47 against a pretty elite defense, James is basically averaging 40 points, 8 assists, and 8 rebounds per game on better than 50% shooting during this four-game win streak. He looks as dominant offensively right now as anyone I've ever seen play the game, and that's not just me as a Rockets guy. I heard David Locke, the Jazz radio voice, saying similar things from the Utah side last night. And so, based on that, with Harden's performance offensively up there with the all-time greats, the question I want to ask you, Nikias, as a national guy that I know covers the league as a whole, is what his defining characteristic is. And to me, it's an interesting question because with Harden, what I keep coming back to is how next level his IQ and his just overall mental understanding of the game is. He's not that physical guy the way LeBron is with just his physique and how powerful he is. Steph Curry, the best shooter that the league has ever seen. Russell Westbrook, the quick twitch muscle fiber. Kevin Durant, the fact that he's an elite shooter and 7 feet tall. With James, he's good in a lot of those areas, his shooting, his athleticism. There's nothing that's elite, but it's just his mental side where it comes together because it feels like whatever the adjustment is that coaches like Quinn Snyder and defenders like Ricky Rubio try and make to him, he's one step ahead. For example, last night, they shade him left because that's his dominant side. Well, he's been perfecting the step back going to his right with each passing year, and that's where he hit the dagger over Rubio, called it the Daggio, late last night. He also threw down that facial with Gobert with his right hand, if you notice, because, well, if they're going to play his left side, then that's what's going to be open more often. And I think he even had a move in the middle of the fourth quarter, Nikias, against Royce O'Neal, a pretty quality defender. He backed him down from back to the basket, traditional post style, which you almost never see from James, about 14 feet from the bucket, and then kind of flowed into a step back from there. So to me, it just seems like that whatever the adjustment is from opposing coaches or players, his mental game is just so strong that he's one step ahead of the curve. And so to me, that's kind of the thing that I go back to that makes him so historically unique. So I'm just curious, your take as someone that I know follows all of these guys and also some of the historical greats, what's the defining characteristic of James Harden?
It kind of goes into what you said. It's his mindset. He's incredibly intelligent. He sees the floor well. That's why he's able to pick teams apart and pick and roll the way that he is, because he's seen all the coverages. He knows how to beat it. If you shade him one way, he has enough counters to beat you the other way. What kind of stands out to me when it comes to him is that he kind of makes opponents go away from their natural instincts. And that kind of flows into how he draws all these fouls, because obviously you want to have your arms out. You want to kind of disrupt this dribble. The second you stick your arm out, he's going under your arm and drawing a foul. Everyone know, I mean, you try to shade him to the right, you know the step back is coming, so you want to contest that. You want to crowd the space there. You do that, he's going to land on top of your feet, and he's taking 3 free throws. If he's on the drive, once he exposes the ball, naturally you want to swipe at it. You want to try to get a deflection and go the other way with it. As soon as you stick the ball out, he's so strong, you're not knocking it away from him. And then he's also so crafty, you're hitting his arm, he's going back to the line. So at that point, you're kind of playing without your arms. You don't want to press him too much. And if you give him space, then he's able to hit any shot that he wants to get into. And then once you start sending extra attention, then he's picking you apart with these cross-court passes. He gets downhill and pick and roll. He's throwing lobs. He's throwing skips to the corner. So there's virtually no way to defend him, and it just gets frustrating from there.
That completely flows into my next topic, which is, of course, the national outrage over the travel that wasn't called in the last minute of that game. Look, James scored 47 points. Ultimately, he got 3 free throws out of that, made 2 of them. So even if you take that away, he had 45 points and was brilliant. But there's a certain, I guess, just polarizing aspect to him. And it sounds like what you're saying is that his game is so unprecedented in terms of how he does it that just rubs folks the wrong way. Maybe they're just not used to it. But as an outsider, what do you think it is that drives folks so up the wall? Because NBA Twitter hashtag has been all over this since last night, even though he was otherwise brilliant. And it's a bit of a shame because it's not like James is alone in getting a break here or there. You know, the subsequent possession, Donovan Mitchell got 3 free throws when he jumped right into Eric Gordon, who was stationary. But when it's not James Harden, a lot of fans look the other way. Whereas with James, I suppose it's his uniqueness, but something about it makes it always stand out to where even if there's not this data to where you can point to, oh, he's always getting this benefit of the doubt, for whatever reason, it stands out more with James. Why do you think that is? Why are the talk shows, you know, referring to this travel as opposed to pointing out that, hey, even if you take away those 2 points, he still had 45 points and was brilliant and really has been, averaging 48-8?
I think in this case, the travel was so egregious, it's kind of hard not to talk about it. Because, I mean, like Candace Parker said on the Players Only broadcast, it was basically a step back. And you, like, we see LeBron James on the fast break, he'll take 3 steps. Lonzo Ball against the Hornets on Saturday actually took like 4 steps after a steal and went for a dunk. And you kind of saw some videos floating around with that. So, I mean, other players traveling, the refs missed some pretty bad ones. But, like, that one was kind of unprecedented. I don't think anyone has ever seen basically a double step back in front of a ref and it doesn't get called. So I can kind of understand why that one specifically definitely rubs some people the wrong way. But I think in general, James does kind of have a rep of not cheating, but he takes the rules to the extreme.
Okay.
He knows the rule book. He knows what is a foul, what isn't. And that combined with referees being inconsistent already, it just kind of puts pressure on them. And then once he's getting these calls, it just kind of frustrates the fan that may not understand why he's getting these calls compared to other ones. And just in general, I kind of get the argument that he isn't fun to watch.
Mm-hmm.
So he is incredibly skilled. He is sneaky athletic, as funny as that term is for him. He can dunk on people. He has a tight handle. He can shoot. But if you're tuning into a game, a Houston game on a random Tuesday, you might see James taking 10 or 12 free throws with those calls coming up, some stuff that looks questionable if they're not questionable. So I can kind of understand where the narrative comes from. And then just that travel in general was just so egregious. It's kind of hard to ignore that one.
I want to flow into some non-James Harden topics, and this will be a bit of a mixed bag discussing Clint Capela and Chris Paul. I'll start with a guy in Capela who's been certainly good for the Rockets on the defensive end of the floor, especially with regards to his rebounding, his shot-blocking presence. He continues to get stronger. His stamina continues to improve with each passing year. Just 24 years old. That's the good. The not-so-good, he has not been the same from the outset this year. Maybe he's a touch heavy. I'm not sure what it is. Defending perimeter players on switches to the point where in the past week, the Rockets are now starting to drop Clint Capela in their defensive coverages. They're only switching 1 through 4. It's something they did a lot last year when Nene was in the game. Well, now they're doing it with both Nene and Capela. And Nikias, I'm curious your take on why they're doing this and if it's a good decision. The reason why I lean to it being a good decision, I know that you will have some asking that, well, isn't switching paramount to beating the Warriors? And at this point, when you're 30 games in and you're barely above 500, at some point you can't just start preparing for a Warriors series in May. You've got to get through 82 games. And it seems clear that the status quo to start the year, something had to give. And so part of it, maybe Capela isn't as light on his feet as he was in the spring. I'm not sure what it is. But the other issue, when you look at Houston on the defensive end of the floor, their most consistent issue, the reason they've been a bottom five, bottom 10 defense all year long, it hasn't even been perimeter defense for all that's been made of Ariza and Bamute. The part of their defense that has consistently lagged, they have always been one of the bottom three or four in the league in defensive rebounding rate. So if you drop Capella, not only are you kind of mitigating his weakness in terms of him not playing as well in the perimeter defensively as he did a year ago, but you're also potentially improving that rebounding rate, which when you look at their defensive problems, the amount of offensive rebounds they give up has been by far the most consistent issue all year long. So to me, even though it may not play that well to their long-term how do you beat the Warriors in the best of seven series, and of course it's difficult to make schematic changes like this on the fly during the NBA season, to me, I kind of see why they're doing it. Is that something that you agree with? Did it catch you by surprise? Just your general reaction to the change they've made in the past week to 10 days of dropping Clint Capella defensively?
I would definitely agree with that observation. It's actually something that I was calling for earlier in the year when they were a few games under 500. I mean, going into a game knowing that Houston's going to switch everything, it's just easy to plan for from a schematic standpoint. You still have to execute, but you know what Houston's going to throw out there. And it just got to a point to where teams would just walk down the floor. You would see like a 1-5 pick and roll or a 2-5 pick and roll, not even to try to get downhill, but just to force the switch. And then once Clint Capella's on the perimeter, even if he hangs with a guy, you have a mismatch somewhere else. And if a shot is missed, then you're getting killed on the offensive glass. And Houston was just getting ripped to shreds. So I think dropping him obviously mitigates that a little bit. I think an underrated part of this is that Clint Capella is playing by far the most minutes he's ever played.
Fair.
In his NBA career. So trying to keeping him near the basket, keeping him out of the torture chamber with guards can kind of conserve his stamina a little bit since you're going to need him more. So I think that's a smart decision. And just, I guess, flowing into the Chris Paul thing, they have really tried to make sure he doesn't switch as much because he hasn't been as impactful as a defender as he's been in recent years, and they're trying to keep him out of those big, small mismatches. So dropping Clint definitely... I mean, Chris Paul is more at home in kind of like a drop coverage where he can fight over and kind of pester guys from behind if he does fall behind instead of banging with a 6'10 guy.
Before we get to Chris in particular, I want to continue with this theme of the switching because when I was working with the Jazz radio crew, I was doing some stats for them during Monday night's game. One thing that they kept pointing out was that the switching scheme for Houston this year, it didn't catch opponents by surprise the way it did a year ago, because no one until the Rockets a year ago had really switched 1-5 to that extent. And to me, it really seems like something that could explain some of these baffling things we've seen early in the year, because everything that Rockets Twitter has been trying to understand is, okay, look at Ariza and Luke Bamute. It's not like these guys are world beaters in Phoenix or L.A. Bamute's barely played, and of course, you go back to the Western Conference Finals, and Luke was a relative non-factor. He's certainly a quality defender, so is Trevor, but it doesn't explain everything that's happened on that end. Certainly, they have a role in it, but I think what makes the Jazz broadcast theory more plausible is that even if you brought back the same personnel, you might still be having some similar issues in that teams are more schematically, tactically, whatever you want to call it, prepared to attack the switching scheme in a way that they weren't a year ago. Is that something that you've seen this year when you watch the Rockets on film?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Like I said, you have basically a year plus of film on Houston switching everything. And switching in general isn't anything difficult to decipher. Defenses typically want to switch because you want to take away those crevices that teams use to get downhill. So once you switch actions, you can't get a head start. You can't gain those advantages. And then that's where you don't have those breakdowns that force guys to rotate and things of that nature. But in general, I think teams across the league have gotten smarter about switching, and I think that's part of why posting up is starting to make a little bit of a comeback. I don't think it'll ever be to the extent that we saw in like the 80s or the 90s. But being able to beat switches, especially those big, small switches, is becoming more important. And that was kind of what stood out to me. If you want to go back to the season opener against New Orleans. Mm-hmm. New Orleans would walk down the court, they'd set a pick, and then you would have Chris Paul guarding Anthony Davis. You would have James Ennis on Anthony Davis. And once the help comes, Anthony Davis is picking you apart with, I think he had, what, 8 assists in that game.
Mm-hmm.
So I think teams have gotten a lot smarter about how to beat switches. And so that's just it from the schematic standpoint. Then you get into the Houston personnel. They are a little bit smaller than they were last year. And that gives offenses more things to pick apart if they force a switch, or if they miss a shot, then you can, again, attack on the offensive glass, and that's where Houston has struggled as well.
Sure, and it's definitely a combination of the two, personnel plus, I think, increased familiarity. To get to Chris specifically, because for the season as a whole, certainly the individual contributors, Chris Paul and Eric Gordon, those are by far your biggest drop-off relative to their expected efficiency. Eric shooting just 37% from the field, 29% from three. With CP3, he's at 46% from the field a year ago. This year, he's at 41%. Three-point stroke has fallen from 38.5% to, I think, 35%. Even the free throws have fallen from 92 to 80, which you wouldn't think had any sort of aging component to that. Defensively, as you mentioned, they have to take extra care because he's not a guy that can stick on the perimeter with a lot of quicker players. And Nikias, what's interesting to me, you know, there's this narrative, I'm not going to say there's nothing to it, but because Chris Paul is 33 years old and he's in year 14, anytime he has a low light, there's a segment of NBA Twitter, Rockets Twitter, whatever it may be, that says, oh, he washed. And I'm not going to say that there's nothing to age taking a toll on him. What I am going to push back on is the idea that every time we see him get blown by on the defensive end or on the offensive side, not be able to create as much separation one-on-one, that all of a sudden it explains for this drop-off that we've seen relative to last year, when keep in mind he was number one in the entire league in real plus-minus. Now, compared to earlier in his career, Chris Paul, 5-10 years ago, yeah, of course he's nowhere near as explosive. But I don't really see his athleticism as dramatically different than, say, 6 months ago when he was really good in the playoffs in April and May. I don't think he was that great of an athlete then, and I saw a lot in the playoffs, especially the first two rounds, Minnesota and Utah, guys went straight by him at will. It wasn't like he was a great athlete then. It just seems to me, Nikias, that for whatever reason, maybe it's mechanics, maybe it's an acute injury, but a lot of those mid-range type shots, the floaters that he was good at a year ago, for whatever reason, it's not like to me the separation he's getting is all that much less. It's just the shots that we saw him make a year ago are not going in now. And so that's what I kind of want to push back on with regard to the Chris Paul aging comparisons. I don't think that it's totally invalid, but I think we need to make sure that we're doing an apples-to-apples comparison. Because if you're comparing Chris Paul to the CP3 of 10 years ago, yeah, of course, he's aged dramatically. What I think is the more interesting comparison is Chris Paul of 2018-2019 to Chris Paul of 2017-2018 and what is different in regards to his first season in Houston. So on that front, Nikias, is it just a matter of him missing shots, or what do you see that's different this year for CP compared to a year ago that might explain at least some of the drop-off?
I think the number one thing is definitely the shot making. I have B-ball reference pulled up right now. In that 3 to 10 feet range, that floater range, the little pull-up range that he's normally been elite at, he's a career 48.5% shooter. This year he's at 37%, which is about 9.5% lower than last year and well below his previous career low, which came in his rookie year, and that was at 43%. So he has pretty much been as bad as he's ever been at his best area. And that typically doesn't happen. We've talked a little bit about his elbow. I think that's bothered him a little bit earlier in the year. I'm not sure how much of an impact that's playing right now. But in general, I do agree with you. There's been like a slight dip in athleticism, but nothing drastic. He's still getting to his spots. He's still navigating the floor well. Between missed shots and, there's been an uptick in turnovers. He's been a little bit better during the winning streak. But that's really been it. He's just been a little bit off, and maybe that's the elbow, but I'm not sure how much you can attribute that to aging. I think that part of it should come back, and if he's still getting to his spots, he should be fine moving forward.
As we finish up the podcast, we'll turn our attention to the next two games. The Rockets have a back-to-back coming up Wednesday night at home against the Washington Wizards. That's Trevor Ariza's new team, so hopefully the Rockets will have a nice tribute video for him. If you're going to Toyota Center Wednesday night, please cheer Trevor. He did nothing but play his hardest for 4 straight years here, 5 seasons in total in Houston. Great guy. I'm sure he would appreciate it, and it would reflect well on the fan base. And then Thursday, Nikias, they are in Miami against your Miami Heat. I know you've followed and written about them for a while. So Eastern Conference teams, they may not be in the wheelhouse of traditional Rockets fans. However, I know that you follow that side of the league quite a bit. So Wizards Wednesday, Heat Thursday. Keep in mind it is a back-to-back, and a back-to-back in which there's a long plane flight from Houston to Miami in between, latter on national TV. Just curious how you see those matchups and what the keys are that the Rockets should look for, you know, for better or for worse, if they want to keep this winning streak going now at four games during this upcoming back-to-back?
I think in general, I think Houston definitely has the talent to win both of these games. I know that trip to Miami is going to be a little bit tough for a multitude of reasons. But I do think Houston has enough talent to do that, to get things done there. Against Washington, there's still no Dwight Howard. James Harden and Clint Capella in pick and roll should be their bread and butter. Chris Paul should be able to get to where he wants to go unless John Wall decides he wants to play defense, in which case that could be a pretty fun point guard battle. Against Miami, I'm a little bit intrigued because, again, Houston is the better team, but Miami has been sprinkling in more zone defense than ever. I just wrote about them. They're allowing, I think, 81 points per 100 possessions when they go to zone this year. And wow. Houston has had cold streaks shooting the three ball. So if Miami is able to force the ball out of James Harden's hands, if they don't get contribution from Eric Gordon, who's been very inconsistent as a shooter, Chris Paul is down, James Ennis has been a little underwhelming as a shooter, I think there's definitely a chance for Miami to keep things close if Houston's cold from deep. But either way, I do think Houston should be able to win both of those games.
Yeah, and Ennis, of course, expected to be out with the hamstring strain. The good news for the Rockets, they get in very late night to Miami. In some respects, that might be better than if you had a free day in Miami before the game. But, no doubt, the Miami factor can be very real for a lot of NBA teams. And unfortunately, we've seen it in the past with the Rockets. Hopefully, the schedule will mitigate that aspect, although it will play up just the normal back-to-back fatigue angles. And, Nikias, while we're talking about fatigue, last subject I want to get to is the issue of depth, which has plagued the Rockets off and on this season. They now have a free roster spot with the waiving of Chauchi yesterday. Now, of course, there are tax benefits to them doing that. But for a team that has had depth issues off and on the whole year, when you see an open roster spot, there are things that you can do to fortify that depth and certainly help the Rockets, potentially from a defensive perspective, from a rebounding perspective, some of the issues that we've discussed throughout this podcast and really that we've seen throughout the year. I know one guy that you were fairly high on that got released yesterday was Austin Rivers. He was dealt in the Ariza trade to Phoenix. They let him go. Some reports have him signing with Memphis, so he could be off the board. Although, as of late afternoon, there's a lack of clarity with those, so we'll have to wait and see. Either way, with Rivers specifically, of course, there's a backstory between him and the Chris Paul era Rockets that may not make him the best fit. But now that the Rockets have an open roster spot, in theory, they do have flexibility. I know some will say, well, can't you give that to Daniel House? Well, yeah, but he's got nearly a month left on his two-way, so there's no incentive to rush into that. And they still have the Michael Carter-Williams and Carmelo Anthony roster spots should they need it later. So I don't think there's any imminent urgency with what to do with Daniel House. So it's possible the Rockets could just reap the benefits of tax savings, especially because they're relatively healthy right now outside of the aforementioned Ennis. But as someone that follows them and you know what their weaknesses are, if you could bring in one player, I'm not going to ask you to name a name because that's conditional largely on who gets dropped as we get closer to buyout season and so on and so forth. But with regards to stylistically, is it a 3-and-D wing? Is it somebody that to help out with the aforementioned rebounding issues? If you could address something with that roster spot in a perfect world, what would the type of depth piece be that they bring in?
I surprisingly believe in Nene right now. He's played pretty well since he's been back. If he wasn't playing as well as he was, my thing would be to try to add a third big. I have absolutely no faith in Marquese Chris, and I've been pretty adamant about that.
Yeah.
A guy like Willie Reed is still available in the free agent market. He's a good rebounder, rim roller. He kind of fits what you want to do and can actually do it without being a total liability elsewhere. But with Nene playing well, Brandon Knight has played well, played very well against Utah last night. Had a nice stretch in the first half where he was defending well, hit a three. I think you look for some more wing depth you can find. It scour the G League, see if there's anyone worth taking a flyer on. Try to get some more shooting in there because Houston obviously takes more threes than just about anyone, but their percentage has not been great. So getting more of a pure shooter in there that can kind of spell Eric Gordon when he's cold or something like that, just to sprinkle in some in to see if you can find something at the bottom of the barrel, I think that would be a nice flyer to take until the Daniel House decision comes.
Sure, and you've got until early January for that. Folks, he's Nikias Duncan. You can follow him and read his work. Easiest place to get him, because he writes for a number of great sites, is on Twitter, @NikiasNBA. Nikias, thank you so much for the time. Have a good one, and I'm sure I'll see you back at Toyota Center pretty soon.
Of course.
Good chat there with Nikias Duncan, again, at NikiasNBA on Twitter. I really enjoyed it. Thought he hit up a lot of themes very well. So with that, I think we can put a bow on this off-day episode of Locked On Rockets on this Tuesday, December 18th. It'll be the last off-day episode for at least a couple of days because Wednesday and Thursday, as mentioned, the Rockets are back in action, home against Washington, and then at Miami, another TNT game on the back half on Thursday. So until our recaps of those episodes, this is where we will leave off. If you want more content in the interim, including in-game analysis starting tomorrow night, the best place to get it, of course, is on Twitter. I'm on there at Ben Dubose. That's simply my name. The show is on there at Locked On Rockets. And Nikias is on there at NikiasNBA. That's NikiasNBA. And if you're following people on Twitter and other social networks too, for that matter, of course, we've got a Facebook account at facebook.com/LockedOnRockets. But another resource you should take advantage of is our Locked On NBA Network curated feed, which brings you insights from all across the association, local experts on each team, just as I am on the Rockets. We've got experts across every other team in the NBA as well. So if you want local experts and to see what, say, Wizards fans think about the Rockets, the pulse of Miami on Houston in Thursday night's game, then if you follow on Twitter or Instagram at LockedOnNBAnet, then you will get the responses from not just myself, I'm a part of that feed, but also experts from across the NBA, including the Wizards and Heat as well. Other plugs I should mention. Email, lockedonrockets@gmail.com. That's another way to get in contact with me if you've got any longer questions about the Rockets, suggestions for the show, or inquiries about how to become a potential sponsor of our rapidly growing program. Got a very passionate and growing audience of Rockets fans, especially with them playing this well. Got some great introductory specials. So be it questions about the team or advertising inquiries, lockedonrockets@gmail.com is a great way to get in contact with me. Also, if you've not subscribed to the podcast already, please do. iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, Spotify, so on and so forth. Subscribe. That's how you get episodes out and delivered to your inbox even before I'm able to post them on Twitter. If you'd also be kind enough to leave a 5-star review, that's how you'll get the benefit of episodes when they come out, and I'll get the benefit of boosting our subscriber figures and our ratings and looking attractive to potential advertisers so that we can keep the business model working here at Locked On Rockets as the most regular podcast covering Houston Rockets basketball. We're also working with various voice assistant programs, so if you're in your car and using hands-free devices, just say play podcast Locked On Rockets, and that should be another way that you can find our latest episodes. So with that, this is where we will leave you on this fine Tuesday. Thanks to Nikias Duncan for joining us. Thanks to you for listening, and please come back soon, especially tomorrow and Thursday when the Rockets have games against the Wizards and the Heat, for more analysis of Houston Rockets basketball right here at Locked On Rockets.